Если какие-то вопросы, не стесняйтесь задавать. Или говорите, вот здесь непонятно, пожалуйста, объясните.
So I start?
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So thanks, Dimitri, for giving me this opportunity to share some of our work that we do in our institute. The topic is application bioinformatics for infectious diseases. What it means is that there are many pathogen genome sequences are sequenced, and how we use bioinformatics approaches to identify virulence factors or targets as to be used as anti-infectives and so on. Infectious diseases, you may recall that it causes a lot of damage, not only to humans but also to animals and agriculture plants. So there is need to develop new reagents like vaccines and therapy drugs against the pathogens. So we hope that the new information we get from the genome sequences of pathogens will help us in identifying these points for targeting. So you have seen the lecture of Professor Schreiber. He explained graph theory, and using centrality concept you can identify some points which are in the network which can be used for targeting in pathogens also. But as I understand, the requirement is you must know beforehand the experimental details of the interaction network, and then only you can build the network. So in most pathogens, this information is not easily available, and it takes time to do those experiments. The second lecture, Hofstadt, he presented Petri nets, which can also be used for the networks of proteins and metabolic small molecule interactions and the flows. But again, here we need to measure the flow of metabolites in time before we can use those networks for dynamic construction and identifying targets. So in the meantime, what do we do? We have to develop methods by which we can identify some possible targets using existing approaches. So the way we do it is so topic is how we make general method to identify candidate proteins as anti-infectives. So general method, the method must be general because there are many pathogens, virus, bacteria and parasites. These are eukaryotic, prokaryotic and virus pathogens. They are different types and they have different phylogeny position. They have different biology, and so if we develop something based on orthologous information, then it is dependent heavily on the characterization of the homologous organism. So we have to develop method which is somewhat independent of this orthologous mechanism. So we moved into using compositional property method. Dimitri?
Okay. Вот как упоминалось на лекциях Фалька Шрайбера и Рафи Хофстадта, если известна генная сеть, то очень легко можно, анализируя ее структуру, предсказать целевые белки, которые могут ее разрушить, дисфункция которых может разрушить сеть. И таким образом мы будем бы знать белки, которые могут быть служить целями для лекарств. против патогенов. На самом деле для этого информацию нужно знать о всей сети, чего, как правило, у нас сейчас очень трудно добыть эту информацию. Поэтому вот коллеги Сринивасана, они пытаются разработать другой метод, который работает в отсутствии такой информации, и в том числе даже в отсутствии информации о гомологичных белках. То есть, когда фактически, и, как правило, для патогенов, хотя секвенирование происходит, но информации очень мало. И вот они пытаются использовать информацию, которая, построить подходы, которые не требуют ни знания сети, ни знания даже, в общем-то, и гомологичных белков. Окей.
So, we use a multivariate method for describing the properties of proteins. This is really very simple formula. The first one is on charge. So this is basically this variate number one we call. This is percentage of charged amino acid. And we take the pH of 7.2, which is somewhat standard. May not be applicable in all situations, but we first proceeded with the standard set. And we define this as the percentage of charge in this manner, where L is the length of the protein. Then the second variate we make is the percent hydrophobicity. Now here we have some complication. There are more than 30 scales of hydrophobicity. So which one to take? So here we used four different hydrophobic scales, one each time, and these are these scales for Chaplisca, Hopps and Woods, Kite and Doolittle, the very common standard hydrophobic scale, and also Rowe scale. So these four scales were used individually in different analyses, and the hydrophobic amino acids were classified according to these scales, and the percentage of the hydrophobicity was calculated. Then we have variate number three, which is the compositional distance of a protein sequence. So here we use the Minkowski metric. With R equal to 2, then it is Euclidean distance. R can go up to from 1 to n. And we use this Euclidean distance concept here, where we have Ox is the observed number of amino acid in the protein, and Ex is the expected number of amino acid, and that is calculated simply giving equal probability for all the amino acids, and computing this distance and then normalizing it to the length of the protein. This calculation of this expectation is not realistic. It is something hypothetical. It is a hypothetical case where all amino acids are having equal probability. So, which means that all the proteins that we are looking at is being mapped to that hypothetical reference frame. Then we have another variate, which is called the dipeptide distance. This is something analogous to Manhattan distance. This is also called the taxi distance, because in Manhattan the streets are all rectangular, square. So their distances are always added up, L plus 1, L1 plus L2 plus L3, the sides of a rectangle. So here this is taken as modulus, number of observed distinct dipeptides, not all dipeptides, distinct dipeptides minus the number of expected distinct dipeptides. And for proteins of length less than 800 amino acids, this is maximum is supposed to be L by 2, because you can have only 400, and for greater than 800, this is set at 400. And then we divide this by L, which is the normalized measure of the distance in distinct dipeptides. Then we have variate 5, which is again called a hydrophobic distance. This is part of the main distance. This is also Euclidean distance, but here what we do is we take the observed number of hydrophobic amino acids in any one of the scale, and the expected number of hydrophobic amino acids is computed by taking equal probability of all the hydrophobic amino acid. So what this means is that whether the side chain volume will make any difference. If hydrophobicity alone is required and side chain volume does not matter, then any of the hydrophobic amino acid could equally well substitute, almost, in theory. But in practice, that does not happen. There is always a bias towards one hydrophobic amino acid or the other. For example, tryptophan and cysteine are very few in proteins, whereas other hydrophobic amino acids are little higher in protein. So by taking a hypothetical reference frame of equality again, we then calculate the protein distance from this reference frame. So this is all hypothetical reference frames from where we measure the distances of the protein. Then what we do is we get this multivariate data, which, yeah.
Короткое объяснение. Идея заключается в следующем, что когда вы знаете некий геном, вы не знаете ничего, кроме последовательности. Вот у вас в геноме насеквенировано там 1000 белков. Как вы из них выберете важные для активности белка без всякой сети? И вот авторы пытаются работать в рамках физико-химических свойств аминокислот. Это заряд, выбирают наиболее заряженные белки, выбирают белки, у которых высокая гидрофобность, ну там в зависимости от различных шкал вычисления гидрофобности, пытаются выбрать белки, которые очень сильно отличаются от какого-то стандартного распределения. Вот, то есть пытается работать в терминах только аминокислотной последовательности, рассчитывая вот эти величины. И для них можно будет определить, если этот белок чем-то очень сильно отличается от среднего белка, то, скорее всего, он, наверное, будет важный. Вот такая идея. Всего там 5 шкал, как вы говорили, разных свойств для одной последовательности получается.
So after this, we use the principal component analysis method, and we now see this is the E. coli proteomes, and you can see that most of the proteins, they come very close to each other, and then there are very few which tend to come out of this cluster, and they stay out of this cluster when you rotate the cube. That is called Verimax rotation. We then look at this more closely in other bacteria, and here this is example of influenza. So here you see this is a little more spread out cluster. There are a few proteins outside this cluster. They come out. They have more distance. But you also can see there is this one, another small cluster of proteins, which is somewhat different from this main cluster. So we check what proteins are there in this main cluster. We find that all the housekeeping functions proteins, metabolic function proteins, they are all present in this main cluster, which is quite broad and quite close. Then there are very few which are some kind of special proteins which belongs to antigens or surface proteins which are of play some role in virulence. They come in this cluster. This was very encouraging to see, because this means that the proteins of the pathogens which have some special role, they appear different from the main cluster. So we then check in all these different bacteria, and we find they all have this same pattern of two cluster. One is big, another is small, and this is what we call type 2 proteomes. And this is type 1a proteome, which is basically a homogeneous cluster with a few points coming outside. So this is heterogeneous cluster. And then what we did was to explain this phenomenon in this publication report. And further, what we did was we did deeper analysis. And this is the case for tuberculosis pathogen, which also has this main cluster, and then there is this another separate cluster. And what we found was that in every pathogen you take, this separate small cluster which comes is specific to that pathogen largely, and has the proteins which are important for its own biological pathogenicity. And the method is general. It is not specific to any organism. So, we could... Yeah.
Вот когда эти характеристики вычисляются для белков, их всех можно раскластеризовать по этим характеристикам. И вот оказывается, все бактерии разбиваются на два типа. Одни, у которых белки все в таких шкалах, они группируются в одном кластере. И патогенные белки, патогенные бактерии, для которых все белки разбиваются на два кластера. Один из них вот такой большой и плотный, а второй кластер сбоку. И как раз во втором кластере располагаются белки, которые являются антигенами, белки взаимодействия с мембраной и так далее. То есть это как раз, вот по идее этой работы, это типичные кандидаты для разработки лекарств.
So, the method is general and it is standard. You can also reproduce it. You can work anywhere, in any computer. The formulas are very standard, so you can easily reproduce. So we filed this patent, which is a method to describe this way of identifying special virulence proteins, anti-infective proteins from the pathogen. It is now accepted by the US Patent Office. And this news I just saw here after coming to Novosibirsk, I found this in the site which explains this thing. Now we move to another method of identifying virulence factors. Is there any questions or clarification?
Can ask questions? Have you some questions? No? Is everything clear? Okay.
Okay, so this is a pathogen. Pathogens are quite complex organisms. They have many evolved, many different ways of binding to the host, staying with the host, and taking good nutrients from the host. So here is an example shown where the pathogen has proteins on the surface which will bind to the host, example human host, and the principle is more or less similar even whether it is animal host or plant host. Then colonization and pathogenesis take place, and then the person is in hospital. So if you have drugs, then the doctors give drugs, or if you have vaccine or antibody, then they can give therapeutic vaccines, or if you have immunization, then when you are a child you will get a vaccine, and that will help in blocking this pathogen to attach to the host cell surface. So how pathogen attach to host cell surface? There are proteins called adhesins, and these proteins, they bind to the carbohydrates, glycolipid molecule of the host cell, or they could also bind to the membrane using outer membrane proteins of the pathogen. This is example of E. coli, urinary tract infection. This is pylori giving ulcer. And this is another example of Arsenia, which sends a signal. E. coli only, which sends a signal and make the pathogen. Make the host to express a protein, which is complementary to the surface protein of the pathogen. This is intelligent. It is duping to make a friendship with the host. Here is another case of friendship. So these they will send some signal by some molecules, phosphates molecules, which will cause some changes in the structure, cytoskeletal structure, and become complementary, and then they bind. So friendship. So these are different ways by which they have evolved these molecules. So again, we have to develop a method which is general and applicable to all pathogens. And we cannot depend only on homology or orthology. So we define some properties of the proteins, such as its basic amino acid frequency, then multiplet frequency, which is the repetition of some amino acids, tandem repeats of the amino acids in the protein, then dipeptides frequency, and here we choose only the top 20 dipeptides, which are different between the pathogen and the between the adenosine and other non-adenosine protein. Charge composition, again referring to pH 7.2. So we have the frequency of the charge composition, and also we try to included the information on the distribution of these charge residues by using the statistical moments formula. And we found that moments order up to 2 to 19 was taken. Beyond that was not useful. This is of course standardized using empirical trials. Moment order higher than 3 is not explained statistically. So this is only purely mathematical formula. Then hydrophobic case, we use the Brendel scale, which is scores these minus 8 for these amino acid residues, minus 4 for these polar, minus 2 for proline and histidine, plus 1 for these hydrophobic amino acids, and plus 2 for these other hydrophobic amino acids. And here also we use the moments formula, which would give some information on not only the presence of quantity of the hydrophobic amino acid, but also their local distribution in the sequence. Okay, so...
Как и в прошлом случае, здесь и заключается в следующем, что есть белки, которые называются адгезины, их четыре типа, на картинке было показано. И вот они также участвуют в присоединении бактериальной клетки к клетке человека или там хозяина. И вот, в принципе, способ их поиска тоже заключается на анализе физико-химических свойств белков. Это вот заряды, гидрофобности. Ну и там были моменты, это вот некие распределения парной аминокислот в последовательности.
Now, what we are aiming to do is to train some artificial intelligence tool. And before doing that, we need to see some considerations of the data sets. So this is explained in this publication, appeared this year. So you need to consider quality, reliability, diversity, size, redundancy, and also have some blind data sets. So to have all these in case of some pathogens is not easy, because the number of proteins characterized is very few, and the data sites has limitations. The second is the quality, meaning the well-annotated data. Many times in the database, you will find lot of wrongs and mistakes of annotated data. Yesterday, our young friend pointed out that in the protein interaction network, there is lot of errors could be there. The same is here. So one has to go through the literature manually and check the data and remove the ambiguous or not clear data. Reliability is, SwissProt is a very good source of data for reliability, because the staff in SwissProt, they are doing exactly this type of work. And as much as possible, you should give preference to take data from SwissProt. And also those which have been characterized by direct experimental evidence. I will show you one example later where this can also be problematic. Diversity. So because we want to make a general tool, so which is useful for all pathogens, so we need data from all different kinds of pathogens, from different phylogenetic taxonomic positions. That is very ideal. But usually we do not come across such nice, diverse, good data set. So these are interesting problems for bioinformatics. And I think Russian mathematicians, you should spend a lot of your energy to build this extendable algorithm to check how we can do the statistical properties and testing with respect to these difficulties. So we of course use only standard methods that are available in the R language programming. So diversity is important. Then size as big as possible is good. There is no limit to size, and we don't know how small would be bad. That is one problem. So this is also another good bioinformatics problem. That is, what is the factor and how much it is important in terms of contribution. So we do it empirical, and I'll show you the examples where we have done only empirical work and managed to get success. Redundancy. It is very common to get redundant information in the literature, and that is usually happens because some people are working almost at the same time on the same problem and they came to the same conclusion. That is good in one sense that it is independently reproduced, but in terms of diversity and redundancy, they go opposite. So we have to remove as much as possible, which will not allow skewness in the data set. Then we also need some data points which is completely different and which is not seen by the training data set in order to have reliable testing. So it takes about 6 months to maybe 1 year to prepare a good data set. If somebody has already made a data set, then you can simply take it. But in our case, we are not so lucky, because many people don't make data set for these type of pathogens. And you do this retrieval, then you do this manual curation. And I think now with Vladimir's text mining tool, this might become automated and easier. Then we do this and produce this high quality database of adhesins. Now we also need the other side of the story, that is the non-adhesins to train the artificial intelligence network. And here we have a problem. The non-adult sins are very, very many. It is huge. Because inside the cell, there may be like 3,000 proteins. But outside the cell, there are few proteins. And we are looking to identify those few proteins on the outside the cell which are important for pathogen. So how do we deal with this completely lopsided data set size in terms of statistics? So here we make some assumption. There is no other way. And the assumption is that we take some representatives. Now how good that representative would be, we don't know. There are no rules. So in this case, we took a representative from yeast, which is from the eukaryotes, one from bacteria, and one from archaea. So the three kingdoms concept of evolution. And we take representative from each one of them, and we take representatives of the housekeeping gene proteins and metabolic proteins, which we know how to function inside the cell, not outside. So then we select this data set of non-adhesin, do one more manual curation. But here manual curation is not very difficult because identifying these proteins are also not very difficult through BLAST and others. And get a non-adhesin database.
Okay, some comments. И идея заключается в том, чтобы, зная вот эти характеристики белков, построить некую распознающую программу, например, на основе нейронных сетей, которая бы отличала эти адгезины от других белков. Но для этого нужно, чтобы ее обучить, нужны хорошие данные для обучения. И вот эта часть работы была посвящена тому, какие данные лучше взять. Они, во-первых, должны быть качественные, чтобы не было шума. Второе, они должны быть хорошие, чтобы можно было им доверять, то есть берутся аннотированные белки точно. Третье, это нужно взять как можно более разнообразные белки, чтобы они были от разных бактерий, чтобы их можно было идентифицировать в разных организмах. Четвертое, выборка должна быть достаточно большой, и в ней не должно быть повторяющихся последностей близких гомологов, чтобы не было, чтобы данные обучались достаточно хорошо. Ну и нужно проводить тестирование. И при такой работе, обучении нейронной сети, обычно нужна комплементарная выборка, не адгезинов. И вот проблема в том, как ее построить. То есть выбирались белки, которые явно не относятся по ключевым словам в базе данных, отбирались белки, которые не относятся к адгезинам, и взяли три организма, это дрожжи, эшерихия коли и архея, чтобы из них скомбинировать, из этих белков, из этих организмов, выбрать те белки, которые называются выборкой нет. А затем на этих данных уже обучается сеть. Подборка таких данных, она составляет от полугода до года. То есть это очень трудоемкая работа. Окей.
So, we now prepared five networks. This is for amino acid composition. This is for charge, this is for dipeptides, this is for hydrophobicity, and this is for multiplets. And each one, this is the input layer, this is the hidden layer, and this is the output layer. So from here we get the probability of finding adhesin using this train network here. Similarly, this network has this probability, and this is PD, PH, and PM. And now each network we test using a test set, calculating how much accurate it is, and we get this fraction correlation efficient, which is then multiplied with this probability, and you get finally the weighted average probability of predicting of adhesins. So now if we take independent data set which is not seen by the program and ask it to classify, then we find that it can above 0.7 you get a maxima here. So these two are different distributions, but you see there is this long tail, and these tails, they overlap. This is more common than this is usually the rule. There is always some amount of overlap between the two sides, and this is called the twilight zone. So in the twilight zone, we have some proteins which is difficult to classify between whether it is a virulent adhesin protein or not. Those which are here are at high confidence, and those that are here are also at high confidence. Now, if you scan all the different pathogens, because it has now become a general tool, so we can use it for all the different pathogens which causes various different kinds of diseases in humans or plants and others. Then if we take the top 50 proteins, then basically what we find is that you always find the one which has been characterized experimentally. They definitely appear in them, in that list. And also the ones which are predicted also are correlated by other algorithms which have indirect correlation of finding motifs which occur more frequently in virulent proteins. And then there are some which are totally new proteins that wait for experimental characterization. And you can see false positives is very few. Some cases it's a little more, but otherwise by and large it is very few. Then we see that examples are these, where in tuberculosis it was not known that this is a adhesin protein, virulent protein. But when we predicted, at the same time also in the literature experimental report appeared, which showed that this has the same properties of virulence. And so is this protein. So both these are being considered for making new vaccines. And in the other case are these ones, which are already in the pipeline for making new vaccines.
Окей, короткое замечание. Когда такая нейронная сеть применяется, вот структура была показана. Если кто-то не знает, можете потом подойти ко мне, я могу на пальцах объяснить, как это работает. Она выдает некое число, по этому числу можно определить. Если она больше 0,7, то это будет точно ангизин. Если меньше там 0,3, то это будет точно не ангизин. А вот между ними некая зона сумеречная. Тут уже не то, не сё. И вот было показано, что среди списка белков номер первый, который был зелененьким, ранее он был, не был известен, что это адгезин, но после того, как анализ был проведен, оказалось, что экспериментальные данные показали, что это был точно ангизин. Ну и другие белки были тоже, по всей вероятности, ангизин. То есть, получается, с помощью такого метода можно определять белки, которые присоединяются к клетке человека и которые могут быть целями служить для лекарств, которые нужно блокировать. Okay.
So, just a few days ago, we heard that the U.S. Patent Office gave acceptance to patenting this method also. Now, how these methods can be used in vaccinology? So, according to Novartis, this is what we have been doing in conventional vaccinology, and now comes the reverse vaccinology concept, which uses the genome based approach, uses the genomic information, and they predict that you can come to making a vaccine within very short time compared to this one. So we decrease by tenfold. And then if you want to increase effectiveness and reduce toxic reactions from other population, then in another 10 years maybe, when structures of many of these proteins are known, then you can make rational design of epitopes. And also I think if many surface protein structures will be solved, then a lot of people will try to develop drugs against these proteins, as Luciano had explained in one of his slides. So this is a way, and bioinformatics is used right from the beginning in reverse vaccinology. That is the difference. And so it has set a new paradigm in the industry. Because in the industry, previous time they were not using bioinformatics in the first. They were conservative and they wanted to use only experimental methods. Bioinformatics was very low. After the success of Novartis, then a lot of people now are trying to use bioinformatics as the first step before going to experiments, because they want to do intelligent experiments and save a lot of money, so that the end product which comes will be more cheaper and afforded by the people of the world. So they predict the subcellular localization, then they predict whether it has probability of being adhesin, and then they predict whether it would have transmembrane domains. This is actually purely related to protein expression problem, because if you have more transmembrane domain, then expressing that protein is difficult. So then you also look at whether there is any similarity to human host proteins or animal host proteins in case of animals. And then you also include epitope prediction and other possibilities in your tool. And then they suggest that this can be used as a platform for discovering these candidates, vaccine candidates.
Классическая биология, она исходила из того, что сначала получался организм, затем его экспериментально исследовали, получали антитела на этот организм. Это вот сейчас достаточно быстро можно сделать. В будущем можно быстро будет получать структуру антигенов и разрабатывать для них лекарства. Информатика идет немного по другому пути. То есть у нас есть белки последовательности, как правило, для них идет предсказание клеточной локализации, являются ли они адгезинами, насколько важна их функция. И все эти информационные методы в итоге позволяют предсказывать в этих белках, будет ли он антигеном или не будет. То есть информатика использует анализы последовательностей и больше ничего.
Now we come to another example of this application by informatics, what we have been trying to help this community. You also saw an example of this in Luciano's slides. So here is the flu attack reports in the literature by Anthony Fauci at the Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in Bethesda. And basically what they are trying to say is the movement of this virus from poultry and birds into humans. And as was pointed out in the last talk, that we don't know the mutations that would cause this jump from species barrier. This is basically the distribution of this disease, and this keeps coming and again. So what is this virus? So if you see, it has this RNA genome, and it has these two important proteins in addition to others. One is the hemagglutinin and another is the neuraminidase, and both are on the surface, and they are they are known to play a role in host-pathogen interaction. This is the structure of the both proteins. And what we did was we looked at over 40,000 sequences of different subtypes. We clustered them using the BLAST cluster program. Then we did this multiple alignment. So you can see this is a very nice HPC problem, I think you can use to see, because we also had to use some kind of HPC. Otherwise, this you cannot do in a workstation, not in real time at all. And then we also checked for their adhesin properties. And then what we did was to map the adhesin property of the neuraminidase versus hemagglutinin and see how it changed. Now you can see this is a strain, H1N1 it is called, and this is I think this type of strain is part of the currently recommended vaccine by the CDC. And you can see the polymorphism. Polymorphism of the changing sequences is such that there are groups of clusters between the two. And these small changes, they occur because they are all transmission of one type of strain from one species to another species and so on. And that is why these are all small changes and they are so closely related here. I think this is some kind of foul which happened to be very different from the other group. Then there is this H3N2 group, which is somewhat overlaps with this group, you can see in terms of these coordinates here, but also has slightly different behavior in terms of the polymorphism. It keeps changing in a slightly different way. And then we have this H5N1, which became the fear recently, and you can see it has totally different behavior from both of these. And again here we can see that there is some polymorphism. So what is happening is that the virus has some big changes which causes these different types of patterns. And then there are some small changes which happen within the transmission locality, local region, which keeps varying from one place to another. So, if you look at the,
этот рассказ про вирус птичьего гриппа, для которого известно, что вот существует опасный штамм H5N1, который может мутировать так, чтобы он, в общем-то, человеку не передается и вреда не приносит. Но в некотором случае мутация может произойти, и он станет опасен для человека за счет того, что вирус начнет прицепляться к клеткам человека. Пока что этого не происходит, но понять, когда и где это произойдет и в каком положении будет мутация, непонятно. Это вот, у этого вируса есть два важных белка, это гемагглютинин и нейраминидаза, про которые, кстати, и Меланези Лучано говорил. И вот для этих белков было рассчитано, для разных штаммов этого вируса, было рассчитано адгезивность вот по этим, то есть их величина адгезивности, вот та, которая была представлена ранее. И оказалось, что эти штаммы между собой различаются, да, H5N1, H1N1 и так далее. Но внутри каждого штамма существует еще вариабельность, вот по одной оси была отложена адгезивность гемагглютинина, а по другой нейраминидаза. То есть это вот белки атаки на человека. Видно, что есть полиморфизм. Достаточно хорошо. Хорошо. Окей.
Yeah. And so what happens is there is a lot of polymorphism in this protein and this protein. And this multiply, the number of possibility is very huge. Huge possibility. So that is the problem with this flu virus and its changes. So now how we can predict what type of mutation will come next and how that mutation will be dangerous, whether it will cross species barrier. This is very tough bioinformatics problem, but certainly very interesting. So this, what we found was that our recommendation we could give, which is that both hemagglutinin and neuraminidase need to be characterized for antigenic properties using inhibition assays for decisions to be taken for strain selection and vaccine production. We must be cautious of flu in birds, ducks and swines around us and conduct surveillance to detect new strains with altered adhesin and antigenic properties. So what we recommended was to we should have these assays set up in centralized laboratories where you can get these virus isolates and test them. And if they are different, then you must isolate those animals and treat them and try to get rid of this disease.
На основе этого анализа можно сделать некие рекомендации, когда отслеживаются новые штаммы вируса и ну, новые генотипы вируса. И вот на этих графиках эти точки откладываются. Если они будут попадать в области, которые существуют сейчас, то никакой опасности не будет, по всей видимости. Но если получается какой-то грипп, который, у которого нейраминидаза и гемагглютинин попадают далеко от этих кластеров, то, скорее всего, он может быть какой-то вредоносный, и уже надо за ним следить более пристально. Вот в этом, собственно говоря, идея заключается.
Может, надо объяснить, что люди с M и H, почему они такие разные?
Понятно? Я думаю, что мы это перенесем. Вот, если вопросы по аннотации вирусов, да, это вот Даниил Наумов, он может вам помочь, в чем они отличаются, эти вирусы. В кулуарах можно будет обсудить. Окей.
So, you need a break or you can continue, then we can continue.
We can make a short break, okay, for 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
And you may ask some questions for Daniil Naumov. He can explain what is H and M.
Дело в том, что этот вирус, вирус гриппа, это, он имеет очень сложную организацию нуклеинового материала, у него есть как бы несколько хромосом, то есть разные гены как держатся в разных РНК. И поэтому теоретически между разными штаммами вируса может происходить обмен, то есть могут образовываться гибридные варианты, когда одна хромосома от одного штамма, другая от другого. Вот. И именно вот это все и боятся, что очень большая может быть генетическая... Ну, увеличивается разнообразие именно за счет такой рекомбинации. Отсюда и название тоже. Там такая N, сколько там? N5, там H2. Значит, это N из пятого варианта, а H из второго варианта. Они рекомбинировали, образовался новый вариант.
Okay, let's go further.
Good. So we got the green signal. So now we start moving into the next topic and application, that is for malaria. From our previous experience of the tool we developed using artificial neural network to identify adenine virulence factors, we found that in our preliminary application that it did not work very well for malaria. Malaria is caused by Plasmodium, and this is a very complex parasite. So you can see the mosquito, after it bites, the sporozoids from the salivary glands are injected in the blood. Because when the mosquito bites, it actually spit. And that spit actually contains these parasites, which will go to liver. And then very quickly it goes to liver. Then it becomes merozoites. Okay. And the merozoites will now go into the red blood cell. And then these parasitized erythrocytes, which are RBCs, red blood cells. And they will be living in, and then the parasite, what it doing is expressing a gene whose protein will come through the red blood cell and then on the surface of the red blood cell. So this protein belongs to parasite on the surface of the red blood cell, but belong to parasite, intelligent. And this has domains which will bind to epithelial cells. So this red blood cells will now be removed from circulation. Otherwise, it has to go to spleen, where it will be killed. So, the parasite protect this whole structure using these proteins to survive. And sometimes they rupture and become these gametocytes, which then go into the mosquito again during a mosquito bite, and develop into okinets and finally again into sporozoites. So very complex life cycle, But this disease, when it infects the red blood cells, it's a very, very dangerous disease. It weakens you, and in case of falciparum, it is definitely likelihood that it will kill you. So these proteins which are there on the surface could be targets. So how do we develop a software to detect this? So again, we use the same general principle, that is, the intracellular proteins and extracellular proteins have different compositional characteristic, and this can be seen with many different references using statistical analysis or any other method. They basically have some different compositional properties, and so we again try to prepare a positive data set with the different surface proteins involved in adhesion. And here is where we faced trouble, because we have to, from our criteria, we have to check for experimental data. So when we first time collected and prepared the tool, then the experimental data said yes, it works as adhesin. Then there is one protein said that it works as adhesin. Then after we submitted, then the reviewer said, no, it not work as adhesin. I attended a meeting recently. Then we communicate to the author who initially published as yes. She told, no, nowadays we don't think it is an adhesin. So then again we have to prepare this set and make this tool again. So this sort of a thing can happen in the subject, and one has to be prepared for it. So again, you see the basic pattern. The positive data set is very small number of proteins, but the negative set has large number of proteins. And here again, we had to apply some assumptions and criteria. And the criteria was the proteins which are not likely to be on the surface included, such as ribosomal or cases like this. But although we may be 90% correct in this, we may not be 100% correct in this, because there are some instances when these proteins supposed to function inside have a tendency to come outside also. So this problem of difference in data set size will keep challenging us all the time in the development of any bioinformatics tool, which is specifically used for this application. So we must develop novel algorithms, methods, which can be used to tackle such type of size differences.
Okay. Ну, на предыдущем слайде был показан цикл малярии, и смысл здесь в том, что когда паразит попадает внутрь клетки, кровяной клетки, то на этой клетке экспонируются белки этого паразита, адгезины, которые позволяют взаимодействовать с другими клетками организма. Вот, поэтому адгезины – это как бы одно из таких наиболее очевидных целей и для борьбы с малярией, чтобы их блокировать. Вот. Ну и для этого также были применены вот методы машинного обучения, но немного другой алгоритм, но в принципе у него такой же. То есть есть обучающие данные, и когда мы на них научимся, некая программа на них обучается, затем мы подаем на ее вход какие-то тестовые данные, она уже по ним предсказывает, что это за белок, адгезин или не адгезин. Вот здесь небольшой, как подбиралась выборка. Это, в общем-то, сделать очень нелегко, поскольку Про белки, как правило, бывает мало что известно, их функция очень плохо аннотирована. И вот получилась эта кропотливая работа, буквально каждую последовательность отбирают, и вот смотрят статьи, вычитывают, адгезин это или нет. Ну и, соответственно, данные по негативным белкам включались те белки, которые, скорее всего, не находятся на поверхности, не связаны с адгезией. Ну и вот эти типы белков приведены здесь. Получилось в итоге 81 белок, который является адгезиноподобным, скажем так, и 1400 белков, которые не являются адгезинами. Вот на этих данных обучалась программа. Окей.
Okay. Thank you, Dmitry. I admire your translation. It's really very good. I won't be able to do it in my language also so well. Okay, so now we move to the next step. This case we use support vector machines, and we only use these two frequencies, which is the dipeptide frequency and the multiple frequencies, because when we analyzed in the bacterial case, we found that these two are the major contributors. The others were not as much good in contribution. That's first difference. The second difference is that we took both negative set and positive set from malaria only, because the malaria genome is 85% AT rich, that is adenine and thymine rich. So therefore the composition of the proteins and the DNA is extremely skewed and very different from the composition of proteins from other species. So therefore we wanted to maintain the same level of bias in composition in both the cases. So both the positive and the negative set was from malaria species. This is different from the previous case. So you can see as we move from case to case, the criteria also changes the way we develop the tools. So you can see here that again we remove the redundancy as mentioned in the criteria. So we have non-redundant master data set which is randomized about 100 cycles. And then we use five-fold cross-validation, which is we divide the data set into four-fifths part and one-fifth part, and then we keep changing this sectioning. Because the first one-fifth is used for testing, then the second one-fifth is used for testing, and the rest is used for training, and so on. So this goes in cycles. And you have about 728 models were generated through PerlScript automation. These were models differing in parameters of the polynomial kernels and the radial basis function kernel values. This is totally empirical method here. And our selection was on the basis of high Matthews correlation coefficient score and low coefficient of variation between the different models. So this is what is our criterion to select the good models. So now we get these cycles of 728 models going through five times, and the learn module learns the data set, and the classifier module classifies the data set in terms of analog values, and since we already know which is what, so we are able to calculate the true positive, false positive, true negative and false negative in these cases. And finally, what we did was to obtain three parameter set that performed equally well. And how do you know equally well? This should have low coefficient of variation among the different models. That means they are equally well. And they all should have high average MCC values. So both conditions must be satisfied. So after satisfying those conditions, then we chose the three parameter sets, and the models had MCC values in this range. And the final parameter sets, three parameter set means 16 is one parameter set, 125 is another parameter set, and 134 is another parameter set. And then within each set there are individual this thing, because there are fivefold cross validation. Okay, so the A, B, C, D, E. Okay, so the C one was the highest among them, and then B was the highest among them, although they were all equal, but C was still highest, so we took C. And then so we have six models here, and a given sequence, when it is analyzed through each of this model, we then take the maximum of the score, which is the union of all these models. This criterion has little bit danger in that it might give some false positive, but advantage is that we will not miss very much, and that is required in this case of malaria. And when we tested it in the whole genome sequence, we actually did not find much false positive.
Ну вот здесь был представлен метод построения распознавания адгезинов в геноме малярийного плазмодия. Проблема в том, что если в предыдущих методах использовались как такие случайные наборы аминокислот, которые просто 1/20, да, все аминокислоты равновероятны, то здесь этот случай не проходит, поскольку геном малярии, он является АТ-богатым, и поэтому частоты аминокислот очень резко смещены, просто потому, что чаще встречаются нуклеотиды А и Т. Соответственно, кадоны будут не те, которые в среднем по белкам находятся. Поэтому для формирования негативного набора данных использовался тоже геном микобактерий. Вот, дальше. Здесь применялся метод опорных плазмодия, да, применялся метод распознавания, основанный на машине опорных векторов СВМ. Это тоже некий черный ящик, куда на входе подаются данные, она предсказывает по ним, является ли это адгезином или нет. Но у этого черного ящика может быть внутри различная структура. Вот авторы отпробовали огромное количество, порядка нескольких сотен различных структур, и каждую они тестировали по коэффициенту корреляции Мэтьюса, этот MCC, это соответствие предсказания, значит, вот, истинным данным. И второе, разброс параметров при предсказании должен быть минимальный. Это вот CV, коэффициент of variation. То есть каждую сеть они перебирали огромное количество разных структур этих сетей распознающих и выбирали те, которые наиболее оптимальными. Из них вот они отобрали несколько сетей, которые проиндексированы с номерами CB и так далее. Это разные сети, обученные на разных данных. И в итоге этот вес, по которому они решали, что это будет адгезин или нет, это некая комбинация весов, полученная после работы вот этих вот сетей. Вот, собственно говоря, это огромная вот такая вот машина перелопачивания данных в разных направлениях, да, и в итоге получается вот такой комплексный скор. Ну, задача действительно очень сложная, и данных, проблема в том, что очень мало данных. То есть, если бы было там 1000 там, или 100 тысяч входных данных, было бы гораздо легче, поскольку информации много. А здесь приходится вот комбинировать структурами сетей. То есть это вот действительно очень сложный случай. Окей.
Okay. Thank you. These are the standard formulas for the Mathews correlation coefficient. And these are the parameters, details, and the functions of the support vector machine, which was useful in able to identify adhesins from non-adhesin. In this case, we give this in open source. So this is the site. You can log in here and use the sequences. And if you want, users can change the threshold depending upon their use. And you can see above the threshold is green value and below is red value. and this marking comes nicely. And what we found was that the experimentally verified adhesins from Plasmodium, they all usually have very high scores. And this can be, these were developed by these people. And also you can download the models. You can also improve. Other people can improve it in the open source method. So I move to my next application presentation. This is again on Mycobacterium tuberculosis. This is a very important disease for everybody in the world. And what here we have made is a Sys-Borg application, which is basically moving to systems biology of organisms. So this is the biology of the from the perspective of pathogen. And see here, this is where friendship develops. So the pathogen has protein molecules on the surface which bind to some surface receptors and the macrophages. And I saw a poster, this BGRS, that someone had analyzed some one of these receptors, I think, in the dendritic cells. And there may be many such receptors. And it enters, after it enters, it is, sometimes the battle is lost, so the immune system can clear this. But other times it can change the signal of this host cell. And then it can go into a latent stage. Latent stage means like the latent heat, you know, the quiet transition stage. And here it is believed that some anti-virulence genes may be involved. So this is another new concept here. We have virulence genes and we also have anti-virulence genes. So this will persist for a very long time. So many, many years it will stay, and then when you have some problem of steroids or taking some immunosuppression, then these guys can grow and have disease. So here, this is what it is doing. It is living within the enemy. Sometimes battle is lost, sometimes it hides, and sometimes it changes and hides itself. So it's a complex pathogen. The second point which is important is, normally we think pathogens are those organisms, species, which require something. They need something. They have some genes which are minus in their genome, and therefore those metabolites are not there. So if they get it from outside, then they survive. In case of tuberculosis, it has all the genes. It is not quite in a position of needy. So for tuberculosis, entering this host cell is actually luxury. And it enjoys that luxury. So that is why it has been quite complex to tackle this pathogen. Now if you see the organism, these are the fundamental metabolic pathways. The glycolysis pathway, and this is the pyruvate which links to citric acid cycle pathway. Then the 2-oxoglutarate again links to the glutamine pathway for fixing nitrogen. This is for energy. And this is giving the pentose. So this is the most fundamental of all the pathways. And this is nicely present and conserved in tuberculosis. And it also has these different transporters, multi-transporters, including nutrients and ions, such as oligopeptide transporters. It has kinases, and it has two types of kinases. One is eukaryotic, another is prokaryotic. And it uses this signaling within the cell for adjusting this transport of the nutrients. Then it also has the surface adhesin protein molecules which are used for cell binding and host cell bindings. And it is believed that there may be some neutralizers. It may be secreting small molecule which may deactivate the host peroxides and other toxic radicals. How it does, we don't know. There may be some mutases and dismutases involved in this. So, the fundamental questions are, how does this organism infect? It is known that many people are infected, but only very few people have disease. That is about 5% or 10%, like that. And also, in most cases, the infection does not succeed very well. Then what does it do during infection? That is, whether it goes into a latent state or persistent state, and or whether it goes to different tissues and so on. And how does latency come? And how is this pathogen cleared? That is, in most cases, people are able to remove the pathogen through their immune system. So how it happens?
Речь идет о заболевании туберкулезе, микобактерии туберкулеза, очень сложный у него цикл. То есть в некоторых случаях она может существовать в организме, но быть латентной и не опознаваться ничем. То есть организм ее как бы не видит, если я правильно понял, да. В некоторых случаях она поражает клетки и живет внутри клетки. И вот идея этого ресурса, да, или этой системы Сайсборг, заключается в следующем, чтобы описать на уровне генной сети, вот на уровне генных отношений между генами, между белками, которые секретируются из клетки, белками, которые являются сигнальными до клетки, построение путей каких-то. Вот на этой основе попытаться понять, как все-таки эта бактерия работает. Okay.
So, these are very complex questions. One must understand this step. If you have to understand, if you have to make vaccines, one must understand these steps also, and one must understand this step very well for drugs, because the present drugs, they are given for 6 months or 9 months, and the main reason is for this persistence. So Bill Gates has announced that if somebody can develop a drug which can cure in 1 week, I will give millions of dollars for grant. And many other people also want very fast acting drugs. And but not many companies are interested in making drugs, because there is not much money in making drugs for tuberculosis. Because governments will keep the price low, and they will not allow the company to price it very high. You cannot make much profit, because tuberculosis is a very important disease for all the countries, and everybody should get drugs in easy and cheap form and for quick cure. It is very dangerous for health and the economy of nations, so therefore there is no money in selling the drugs. So the rich companies are not interested in making drugs for tuberculosis. Some, due to TB Alliance, efforts of TB Alliance, Global TB Alliance, some companies, like visionary companies, companies who have vision, such as Johnson & Johnson, they developed some drugs. And also some other groups are trying to develop some drugs, but they are mostly on existing pathways, except the case of Johnson & Johnson. So what we are doing, we are trying to see how we can build up the systems biology pathway using the information available from tuberculosis. So as you know, the genome sequence, which was obtained in 1998, 10 years ago, is a static representation. And from there, we have to go to the dynamic system. And that is where the phenotype is. So that is why we need a dynamic way of modeling. But unfortunately, for tuberculosis, not much data for dynamics is available. Kinetic equations is difficult to formulate. But we hope that we could use statistics methods to overcome these difficulties. This is basically paradigm being followed for systems biology, where we need the networks, as Professor Schreiber and Hofstadt explained. And we need the control of the system, as Professor Schreiber had explained in some of his slides, the dynamics and the strategies. So this is a big task. This is only such a small organism you see in a microscope. And the task is like climbing Mount Everest. And how we propose to achieve this is by networking with different scientists and institutes, like the German-Russian network. So we had our own network. So now it is all networks. So and then there will be Russia-India network. And the network is the most important thing to do now. And this is the network of scientists. You will always find some scientists working individually in network. They will say they are in network, but they work individually. That will always be there in all networks. Then some scientists, like me, will be interacting with many, many people and enjoy all the difficulties in these networks. And the difficulty is because of two problems. One is that the data that different people have is in different format. Okay? And this is a classic problem of integration in systems biology. So how you make an integration platform by which you can integrate different types of data? So there is a lot of data here which is text and descriptive. Then there is a lot of data here which is totally experimental. There is a lot of data here which is mostly predictions. And there is a lot of clinical data and so on and so forth. And they all have different kinds of variables. The microarray data is again very different. So what we did was, there is another thing in the network. Even though the network is very big, but some people like to group among themselves. So annotation people will group among themselves into one block. This is the general tendency. Like people always tend to group together. Pathways people, they are different. They wanted to be here. Then gene expression and regulation is another groups of scientists. Drugs and drug interaction, then the strain polymorphism. The reason is that the language here and the standards and the formats of the data and the complications are present here. These people don't understand. And similarly, these people don't understand the difficulties these people face. So at the micro level, there is always a lot of differences between them. But they will all, without knowing, here there is in the relational data schemat, they will individually come, and then we will use the querying system, which will try to make interactions possible from here to here, from here to here, from here to here. So using software methods, you can possibly get multiple querying system done in such a way that will help. This type of system is now being developed in Germany and many other countries also. So that helps interaction. So they may be working in these individual blocks, but when the user from here, user means this will be usually young user, young student maybe, mostly they are interested in looking at these and these, like that. Nowadays, young students look for cross-pollination. They don't go into this compartmental type of mode. But the old people, they are usually in this compartmental mode. They are specialized, and they only deal with those type of data. So they give good data, high quality, but for systems work, you need integration. So the software platform will allow this integration. And this is shown here is the activity chart which you have to make, because scientists who are in these blocks, they may complain that these guys didn't do much work, and same as this and same as this, okay? So they may have some differences. So to sort that out, we have this pie chart, which will say each one as contribution is in terms of their, which will give the credits for them. And if they contribute more, then they change this and they make it bigger and smaller. So everything is made transparent and open source so that people know about each other.
Вот это, значит, рассказ о том, как информатики не только сети изучают, но еще сами сети эти строят, создают. Вот мы говорили, что есть грид, да, технология, а здесь, когда интегрируются компьютеры и компьютерные ресурсы, эта технология вот, для решения задачи туберкулеза приходится интегрировать огромное количество разнородных данных, то есть это активность белков, там, экспериментальные данные, предсказания и так далее. И все это надо для того, чтобы хорошо анализировать, это все надо, чтобы форматы совпадали, да, это все надо в одну систему интегрировать на разных уровнях, как вот здесь видно. Это все развивается под open source, под открытым кодом, и в итоге как бы конечный пользователь для него не составляет труда всю эту информацию на одном компьютере извлекать, то есть через все эти вот системы интеграции. То есть это довольно-таки сложная задача, чтобы аккуратно представить разнородную информацию. Окей.
So we believe and we think that the first step in bringing about a network of scientists to work together is to have a platform which is open and which is integrating. This platform is actually a computer platform. And experimentalists may have doubt as to how this will allow integration for their groups. So we are providing a format for that also to be done, where we have a portal which will help integrating the experimentalists also, who can exchange their information and also their reagents and other resources for this type of integrative work. This is more difficult than the computational part, but we still believe it is possible. Now, what we have in the Sysborg platform, we have the basic annotation, which is already given by the tuberculist resource, that is already plugged in. And then we also have a lot of other analysis done by other scientists using their own algorithms, such as gene duplications, multiple function, globularity of protein, which is important for proteomics experiments, then subcellular localization, which I showed to you in previous talks, that how important it is, the epitopes prediction and homology modeling. About 700 proteins have been modeled. And the crystal structure data, which is available in the database. Then, in the case of drugs, we also have information on new drugs and their targets. And in case of some drugs, we don't know the target. So, like pyrazinamide, we are not sure of the target. So there is suspicion, and we have put that as suspicion in the database. So there is some difficulty. Now if you want to make a new drug and if you don't know the target, it is very difficult to get approval. But earlier, there are very good drugs like pyrazinamide, whose target is not confirmed. There is suspicion that it works in the fatty acid pathway. And that is a very good drug, and it is given as the first-line therapy. So our job of finding new drugs is made more difficult now because of the regulatory requirements to be met. Information on drug contraindication, second-line drugs, all these have been collected from over 1,000 papers in the literature and entered in the database. This is an important block. As we saw in the case of flu, there are many cases of polymorphisms, which is actually causing concern and worry for the people who are trying to control the disease. And the strain and polymorphism change is a major driver for these pathogens to survive in different locations. So we have two different types of polymorphisms data collected here from about 110 papers or so. And they are on drug resistance, on the existing drugs, as well as the polymorphism between the different strains and isolates as analyzed in different papers. So the difficulty in this data collection is that it is heavily biased. It is more biased towards the genes where the current drugs are attacking, and because people want to know that data more. And there is less data on other parts of the genome. And we know in our own experience that SNPs occur almost in many, many genes in different strains. Even in the in vitro culture of H37RV, we find that if a culture is propagated for many time, then there are SNPs you can observe. And the amount of SNP data that we have collected from the literature is highly biased. So it will have little problem in causing systems modeling. But we have to come up with some method to tackle these biased cases. This is another important block. It's called the host-pathogen interactions. And here we have the data on serology, the antigen antibody data on all the proteins that are known so far. And here again we have some difficulty. You see, after the genome sequence has come, all the descriptions are being done with reference to the ORF ID. But before that, people used to call their own names for the antigens. And there was no standard way of naming the antigens. So it was with great difficulty where people had the information on sequence in the papers. We could compare and we could pinpoint which antigen belongs to which ORF ID. There is a lot of case where we cannot pinpoint to the ORFID. This is sad, but this is what has happened in the history. But now, since the genome sequence has come and we are going to use the ORFID as the standard, we cannot go back. So we have to find some ways by which we can integrate this data. There is a lot of data which sadly we cannot use against the ORFIDs. So we don't know the way a 20 kilodalton one student in some country had isolated. Is it the same 20 kilodalton protein as another? Unless the sequence, the protein is sequenced, or there is a peptide mass fingerprinting done. Now it is possible to do this and compare. So this difficulty we will have in this section of this data. Then in this section is where we have proteins showing similarity at the sequence level with the host proteins. So this is, for instance, called as molecular mimicry in some sense, because there is also a lot of eukaryotic-like proteins in tuberculosis pathogen. Then the surface proteins, which act as adhesin virulence factor, and also the immune responses to different conditions. So,
okay, maybe short comment. Описание этой системы, которая включает как можно более полную аннотацию белков, это вот было на слайде, включая предсказание функции, там предсказание локализации клеточной, предсказание. Это все делается методом информатики. Предсказание адгезивности и так далее. Поиск и верификация этих белков, анализ полиморфизма, это проблемы. Говорилось о том, что данные очень сильно смещены. Как правило, исследуются белки, которые наиболее изучены хорошо. Ну, это такое свойство человеческой природы. А к сожалению, широкий анализ не проводится белков, и это тоже проблема. Ну и здесь вот также одна из проблем – это то, что один и тот же белок может в экспериментах фигурировать под разным названием, и экспериментатор об этом не очень заботится, а вот при аннотации белков это возникает большая проблема. Вот такая интеграция, когда каждому белку присваивается уникальный номер, она здесь в этой базе также реализуется.
Okay.
Then we had the next block, which is actually the gene expression and regulation. Now here there are some challenging bioinformatics problems, which I think students can take it up. One is the promoters. There is no algorithm for identifying promoters in tuberculosis. The tuberculosis organism is GC rich, so it is about 67% GC. So the traditional rule of finding a Tata box and other AT-rich region does not work very well with tuberculosis. So you must come up with some methods which will overcome this difficulty. There is very limited information on the promoter mapping in tuberculosis, because those types of experiments are also not done. In the case of microarray, we have a lot of data, but what has happened is there is only some amount of data given in the public domain. The other lot of data made in Stanford University, they are not giving easily. And if you write to them, then they say that the student has left and gone to do postdoc somewhere else, and then you trace and go to the place, then he said, no, I left it in that computer in the main place, and then you cannot find. So this sort of difficulty happens in these cases as well. So we had a lot of trouble in collecting proper, reliable data on this expression. Finally, we managed to get some. We also have here analysis for the secondary structure elements in the DNA, which has a potential influence on the gene expression regulation, that is also mapped in this case, and it has been described in the database. So the next step was the pathways, where we could luckily get the lot of data from the KEG pathway. So because we get all these from public sources, we have given also back this platform for open source public sources free. So we don't claim anything here. And only thing is the individual analysis, which is done by different scientists, that is a specific addition in this database, which makes this special. Okay, there is not much data on small molecule metabolism now. We have kept this open when this will come, and then we can use this along with PetriNet's modeling for the metabolic flux analysis. The information on transporters is quite reasonable, has been plugged in, and the information on kinases and phosphatases as they are being characterized, they have been also plugged in to reasonable detail. So naturally all this requires good software people along with concerns for regulatory compliance and so on. And there is also people you need specially to look at the intellectual property, because they need to look at the conditions of the distribution of data from different places. So you can look at this database online through internet. That is the best way to see what is there in it and how you feel for it during the maybe sometime whenever you get chance to see. I'll give the URL for this. So this is how the interface works. So you have a small login ID here, which is almost given to everybody whoever is interested in this. And then you can do a search on a specific ORF here, or you can also use some positions of the genomes and so on. And you can get here the list of this and the data that is present in the different blocks. This is more clear here in this case with these institutes. And you can see here, you can ask for which type of query you want to do. And we also have what you call multiple querying system, which I can show you in the demo. Now, here is one type of data which actually helps us and also actually generates some nice bioinformatics problems. So here is a case of the INHA gene, where you see if you map the non-synonymous and the synonymous polymorphisms, they seem to map to almost all over the place. This is overlapped with the CDD data, conserved domain data. And it overlaps with this, and you can see the SNPs occur almost all over the place, and all over the protein, and this is again related to drug resistance. So this is one case like this, whereas here is another case where we have some SNP found, not here, but somewhere here. And here is another case where we have almost all the SNPs are clustered in this very small region here. And this is the zoom of this very small region. Almost all these are drug resistance. So there are different patterns of drug resistance in tuberculosis. And we invite all the people to contribute and participate in different ways, which is actually going into open source mode. So it is, you take it, you take the data, you work on it, you develop, and then you give back to the community. So that is the copyleft approach we are taking here. And I thank all the students from different universities who contributed to this collection of this data in this database. We had taken a long time because I told you the data formats were different, and the integration of all these into a common platform to devise the architecture, it took quite some time for us. So finally, now we are making a move in this direction, and hopefully very soon we will start into the modeling aspect of it. We are now starting a new project. It's called the Open Source Drug Discovery, where this Mycobacterium tuberculosis SysBorg data will be used. And this is basically how this SysBorg data using systems biology analysis will go for target identification. As you saw in the slides of the talks explained before, And then move into analysis and experimental work of protein expression, screening, and you also use a lot of computational methods to do the screening and coming up with leads, which will then be developed further by checking for the toxicities and pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics evaluation, and finally go to the clinical trial. We propose to do this in open source mode, which will, which we think will help in reducing the prices and also to help the students to enter into drug discovery process in the open source way from the academia. Otherwise, they cannot. They have to go to the industry first, and where it is all closed and there is no interaction. So the project has been developed with different work packages in the same format as the European project formulations are done. This is work package one, which is bioinformatics and systems biology package. This is experimental protein expression package. This is modeling package. This is screening package. And then this is lead optimization. And I think this is microarray analysis package. And then this is lead affinity column binding to human proteins and identification of human proteins. It is that package. And then the clinical packages. So this is already started, and it is expected to run for another 6-7 years or so. And let's hope that it will deliver some goods in terms of new drug discoveries. Thank you. That's all I wanted to present.
Okay, any questions? So, I think that we can go to the seminar, and I suggest you to take печенье, в общем, можно взять в коробке и взять с собой по пути, перекусить, да, потому что мы уже немножко из графика выбиваемся. Так, и после семинара тогда у нас сегодня 8 часов, мы приглашаем всех в гостиницу «Золотая долина», там будет автобус в город на экскурсию. Что-то нету. Ну и вообще нет, да?